Hello, everyone. My name is Cheryl Ring. I'm the director of fair housing at a not-for-profit called Open Communities in Evanston. And I'm also an attorney, and I have some private practice experience doing things like litigating landlord-tenant cases, litigating fair housing cases. And basically, my background is in consumer law and housing law. And I'm here today to tell you what you need to know about landlord-tenant law and how that dovetails with fair housing law, and especially for those of you who don't have any experience in landlord-tenant areas, what you need to know, especially for you Illinois attorneys, what you need to know if somebody comes into your office with a landlord-tenant issue. One of the reasons this is important is because, especially nowadays, with the decline of home ownership as a result of the economy, we're seeing more and more renters of all ages, and that means more and more landlord-tenant disputes. And with the way the law is, and it's very much a patchwork, as we'll see, if you don't know what you're doing, not only can you end up costing your client thousands of dollars, but you can also end up seriously malpracticing a case, and that's something that obviously none of us want to do. So I'm going to start by talking about the basics. Most people know about the implied warranty of habitability in Illinois. That's something that comes from a case called Jack Spring versus Little. And it basically just says that when a landlord rents an apartment or a house, then the landlord is warranting that that property is going to be fit for human habitation. And this is actually really important because you see a rise in leases that supposedly rent a property as is. Leases where a landlord tries to disclaim the warranty of habitability, or a lease where the landlord says that the tenant must make all the repairs. You can do that for a commercial lease. But for residential, which is what we're talking about today, you cannot, as a landlord, disclaim the implied warranty of habitability. And that's a mistake that a lot of rookie lawyers in this area make. They put in the same provisions from commercial leases and residential leases. But if you try to disclaim the warranty of habitability in a tenant's lease for a residential property, one of two things is going to happen. Number one, if you are the landlord's attorney, you're going to end up costing your client a lot of money in the ensuing lawsuit. And number two, you're going to end up with the question of whether the lease itself is even valid, because a provision like that can actually, in some circumstances, make the entire lease voidable at the election of the tenant, and then you have a big problem because your client, as a landlord, can be out a lot of money. And on the other hand, if you're a tenant's attorney and you're looking for something that, and you come in with a client comes to you with a habitability problem, that's something that should instantly raise a red flag for you. If you see something in the lease that says the property is as is, or the property is, or the lease disclaims the warranty of habitability, those are things that should raise big red flags and are things that just a landlord cannot legally do in Illinois. Now, what exactly does the warranty of habitability mean in for our purposes? And the warranty of habitability basically means that you are warranting that the property is fit for human habitation. What does that mean? That means that the property is basically fit for people to live in. And that sounds like a really loosey-goosey standard, and unfortunately, it kind of is. But there's a case called Applegate, and that's a really important case, because Applegate discusses what constitutes an appropriate human habitation. And in this instance, it's things like, well, you can't have infestations of bugs, you can't have cracked windows, the doors have to lock, so you have to have heat and air conditioning that work, you have to have running water, things like that. And so those are the kinds of things that are, first of all, the landlord's responsibility to maintain, and second, things that the landlord really should provide and make sure that's spelled out in the lease, that those are not the tenant's responsibility, those are the landlord's responsibility. Now, we'll get to this a little later on. Sometimes the landlord can say the tenant has to pay for things like heat, but that's only in certain jurisdictions, and that's within certain limits. The other thing that's important to understand in Illinois about landlord-tenant relationships is that they're not always governed by the lease. There is this belief among lawyers that are not familiar with this area, that the lease is like any other contract and is governed by itself. In other words, the terms of the lease are and the warranty of habitability, that's all you need to know. And in actuality, it's not. There are lots of laws
in Illinois
cover landlord-tenant relationships in the residential context, and we're going to run through some of them during our time together today. The first one you want to be aware of is the Illinois Security Deposit Return Act. And that basically says what it sounds like. It's a law that says that if you, as a landlord, collect a security deposit from a tenant, and you have more than 5 units that you manage in one complex, you have to return that deposit at the end of the lease. Now, you can still retain some part of it for damage, but there's a very specific procedure that you have to follow in that statute. And that's important to understand. The second big law you have to understand is the Illinois Security Deposit Interest Act. And the Illinois Security Deposit Interest Act is a law that says you have to pay interest on a security deposit that you're holding if you run 25 units or more of residential property in one complex. And there are really big penalties if you don't comply with these statutes correctly. So, for example, let's say you don't pay interest on a security deposit. The penalty for that is paying an amount equal to the security deposit plus attorney fees to the tenant. And that can get really expensive, especially since you're dealing with 25 unit plus buildings. Why? Because the minimum number of units you need for a class action is 25. So these are statutes that really lend themselves very well to class actions where you have a similar violation, just not paying interest. So there's two ways you can pay interest on a security deposit. You can provide it by cash, or you can provide it by rent credit. And I always recommend to landlords that they pay cash and they actually overpay the interest. And there are two reasons for that. Reason number one is that the interest calculations can be hard, and if in doubt, you don't want to end up getting sued over a matter of a few pennies. The interest rates right now are a little low, which means that you can probably be relatively safe in most jurisdictions paying $1 a year, and there's no reason not to overpay that when you're just talking about an amount that small. And the second reason, the second thing I tell landlords is you want to pay it in cash, not a rent credit, because rent credits are really confusing. So here's an example. Let's say that I, as a landlord, were to distribute a letter to my tenant saying, your interest for this past year is $1. Take $1 off of the monthly rent for next month. And your tenant is doesn't understand, doesn't remember, writes a check out for the whole amount. All of a sudden, you violated that statute. Another thing that can happen is if a tenant is in default. Well, under the terms of the Security Deposit Interest Act, and this is important to remember because it's not the same as what we'll find later, under the terms of the Security Deposit Interest Act, if your tenant is in default, the interest obligation doesn't apply. However, the question of whether or not a tenant is in default is a question of fact. So you don't want to stop paying a tenant interest and then be caught flat-footed later if it turns out that you were wrong about what the default was. So if in doubt, given the amount is so small, it's always a good idea to pay the interest and return the security deposit in full because the penalties for not doing so are pretty steep. Now, here's another thing you have to know. There's a couple of important cases. One is called Wong versus Williams. The other is called Gittleman versus Create. And those two cases stand for the proposition that you cannot contract around the security deposit regulation statutes. So, for example, in these particular cases, the landlord tried to put a provision in the leases that said that the tenant waived security deposit interest. And you see landlords still trying to do that a lot in standard leases that say the deposit will be returned without interest. Well, here's the problem. If you do that, courts have ruled that that is, in and of itself, a willful violation of the statute. And so the existence of that clause is actually a per se violation sufficient for you to end up getting hit with that lawsuit. So all you're doing by trying to contract around the statute is pretty much guaranteeing you'll get sued at the end of the lease. So never, ever, ever put a clause in a lease that says that the security deposit will be returned without interest. Never do it. And if you aren't sure whether the statute applies, the safe thing to do is to just pay the interest anyway. It's a small amount, and it's a lot smaller than you'd pay if you were ever hit by a lawsuit. Now, another thing to understand about the Security Deposit Return Act, there is some question as to whether it applies to things other than repairs to the property. And in my own practice, I've seen judges say that if repairs to the property don't apply, then you can keep the deposit under certain circumstances. And that's a very case-by-case inquiry. I've seen other judges say that the only reason under the statute that you can keep a security deposit is for repairs. And that brings us to an interesting question, because you're going to have some of these judges say that only repairs are a valid reason. How do you properly deduct money from a security deposit? Most people think this is an easy question. You just take out the amount of money that you spent. But you cannot deduct from a security deposit money related for wear and tear. What is wear and tear? Well, under cases like Ikari versus Mason, Boyer versus Buell Properties, cases like that, we know that wear and tear is the standard deterioration of a property that you expect from somebody living there. So here's what you cannot deduct, what courts have generally said you can't deduct from a security deposit: cleaning charges, painting charges, replacing light bulbs, replacing wear items that burn out, like sometimes the edging along the bottom of walls can be wear and tear. Now, if your client goes and spray paints everywhere, then probably that's beyond wear and tear. On the other hand, if you're just painting the unit because you're flipping it for a new tenant, then you can't charge your old tenant for that. If you are cleaning it because they left the place a mess, unless you can establish that you would not have had to clean the apartment between tenants, that's wear and tear. And you're not going to be able to legally deduct that from a security deposit. And cleaning charges are probably the number one mistake I see landlords' attorneys make when they're representing their clients. They tell their clients that they can deduct cleaning charges, or they try to put cleaning charges in the lease. And all they end up doing is providing evidence of a willful violation of the Security Deposit Return Act. And that willfulness standard is really important when you're dealing with the state statutes. So the best thing that you can keep in mind if you are a landlord and you are trying to decide whether or not to charge your tenant something: number one, err on the side of returning more of the deposit, not less. If in doubt, return it. It's not worth a lawsuit. Second, if it is a repair that you would have had to make anyway in order to turn the apartment, things like light bulbs, things like cleaning, things like painting, then you can't charge for it. A common one is carpet. If your carpet is at the end of a 10-year lifespan and you would have had to replace it between tenants anyway, you can't charge your tenant for it, even if the tenant damaged it. So those are important things to keep in mind. If it's a wear item, don't charge the tenant for it. If it's a hole in the wall that you would not have had to fix but for the hole being there, that's something you can charge a tenant for, but be careful how you do it. There's case law that suggests that dents in the wall, little cracks, things that accrue over time from ordinary use are wear and tear. So it has to be beyond that kind of ordinary use for you to be able to charge your tenant security deposit. And I highly recommend that you keep really good records, keep really good receipts, and send copies of all of those records and receipts to your tenant if you're not going to return the entire deposit. And make sure you do it within 30 days of when the tenant moves out. Because if you don't do it exactly right, you can end up with being hit with a lawsuit that will cost you a lot more than that security deposit. Now, the other mistake that a lot of landlords make is not knowing what law applies to them. There's a number of state laws that apply to most tenancies in Illinois, and we've gone over the two big security deposit statutes. But there's a number of other state statutes that apply, and we don't have time today to go through the pantheon of them, but I want you to be aware of what they are before we get local. One is the Consumer Fraud Act, or in the full name, the Illinois Consumer Fraud and Deceptive Business Practices Act. Under Illinois law, tenants are consumers. So if you make a representation that isn't true, if you rent an illegal apartment or an apartment without a certificate of occupancy, you risk running afoul of the Illinois Consumer Fraud.
The first verification code is HOT, H-O-T. The first verification code is HOT, H-O-T. Please take a moment and write this down.
And remember, that's a statute that allows for punitive damages and attorney fees to a prevailing plaintiff. So you want to make very sure that you aren't doing anything deceptive when it comes to renting to a tenant, but you also want to make sure that you're being above board and fair, because the Consumer Fraud Act covers unfair as well as deceptive practices, and I've seen a lot of leases challenged on the basis that they don't comply with the Consumer Fraud Act. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have a landlord who provides five-year leases to tenants, multiple-year leases, and that includes in the fine print that the landlord has the right to terminate that lease every few months and raise the rent. Well, under the terms of the contract, the landlord is complying if the landlord does actually terminate the lease and raise the rent, but it's easy to argue in court that is actually a deceptive practice, because you were promised a multi-year lease and that's not what you actually got. So if, for example, you have a multi-year lease or a lease of a year or longer, it's always a good idea to put in some kind of mutual buyout provision, a way for both sides to get out that's equal for both sides and that's separate from any other provision in the lease, a separate rider, for example. And in fact, in the city of Chicago, something like that is actually required by law to be in a separate rider, and we'll get into why in a minute. But the reason it's a good idea to put that separately is that way a tenant knows exactly what the rights are regarding the end of the lease, and a landlord knows there's some kind of certainty if the tenant does want out. And a classic example of that is for a one-year lease, for example, both sides getting the option to terminate the lease with 60 days notice to the other party and a payment to the other party equal to 2 months' rent. And that's something that, generally speaking, is pretty fair for both sides. And usually the law requires that if the landlord exercises that, the security deposit has to be returned in full. So that's something to be aware of. The other statute that you really need to think about that you wouldn't necessarily think about off the top of your head, something called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Now, if you've ever read that statute, you know it's a federal law that governs debt collectors, and that's people who collect debts on behalf of creditors. But what you may not know is that under Illinois law, the Illinois Appellate Court has actually ruled that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act applies to landlords, and that landlords must comply with the FDCPA in any attempt to collect rent. So let's say that you're a landlord, and you then were to proceed to start calling your tenant all the time, saying, where's my rent? Or you were to proceed to provide a five-day notice to your tenant that has the wrong amount of rent on it. Or you try to collect a fee that you aren't entitled to by law. Technically speaking, that's a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and you could be liable under that law. Now, here's where things get a little dicey with that. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has been very reluctant to adopt that holding. And so what you see is you see cases filed in state court under the FDCPA. They're then removed to federal court and dismissed by federal courts which don't acknowledge that holding. But if you refile them in state court, or the case were to stay in state court, then you're going to have a situation where the court is bound to apply the FDCPA. So as a point of practice, if you're representing a landlord and you're sued for an FDCPA claim, remove the case to federal court under federal question jurisdiction, because that case will probably get dismissed. But if you're representing a tenant and you want to sue an FDCPA claim against the landlord directly, then it's always, always filing in state court, because in federal court your case will get dismissed, because the federal courts don't acknowledge that the FDCPA applies to landlords directly. The other thing to keep in mind, especially for us lawyers, is that lawyers are considered debt collectors under the FDCPA. So if you're an eviction lawyer or if you're a lawyer who's representing a landlord, you can be held liable for a violation of the FDCPA if you aren't careful about how you go about representing your client. So make sure you're familiar with that, and I highly recommend going through some resources on debt collection to make sure you know what you're doing, because that's a strict liability statute, and you can get into a lot of trouble. It's beyond the scope of what we're going to do here, but it is important to know. The most important thing you can understand about landlord-tenant law in Illinois is that it's very fragmented. There are four jurisdictions that have adopted in a substantial way something called the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. And if you want to know what the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act is, it's actually available online at a website, www.uniformlaws.org. It's from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. And these are the folks that bring us the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, things like that. These are the laws that are recommended for adoption in all states to provide some kind of uniform body of law. And some states, like Oregon and Hawaii, have adopted this almost in full, and other states haven't. And some municipalities with home rule have adopted it at least in part. And what that does is this creates an interesting patchwork where the laws in question can be very different just a mile apart. So this is really important. If you remember nothing else from this program, this is what you need to remember. The four jurisdictions that have adopted the Uniform Act in a substantial way in Illinois as of the date of this recording are Mount Prospect, Chicago, Evanston, and Urbana. And if you are in one of those jurisdictions, you have to understand what the ordinance says and how it applies, whether you're representing a tenant or a landlord, because the law in an ordinance jurisdiction is completely different than the law outside of it. And I'll take you through some of the aspects of the ordinance and explain why. So when I say the ordinance, I'm referring to the Residential Landlord-Tenant Ordinance based on the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act that was enacted by those four jurisdictions, and I'll say them again, Mount Prospect, Chicago, Evanston, and Urbana. The ordinance itself, the original act itself, dates from 1974. It's been around in Chicago since the 1980s, and Evanston adopted it shortly thereafter. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through the Evanston ordinance simply because it has the most in common with the other ordinances around. There's some subtle differences between all of them, and if I were to take you through all of them, it would probably take a couple of days. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through the Evanston ordinance, and I'm going to recommend that you read the ordinances for each individual city. And I'm going to also recommend that you focus on the subtle differences, because they do exist. The most important part that I can tell you about all of these ordinances, and it doesn't sound like the most important, but trust me, it is. All of these ordinances require, in some form or other, that the tenant be apprised of the tenant's rights at the beginning of the lease. Usually, that's in the form of either, for example, in the city of Chicago, attaching a summary of tenant's rights prepared by the city. Same thing in Mount Prospect. In Evanston, it's actually a copy of the Residential Landlord Tenant Ordinance itself. Now, here's why it's important to do that. Because if you don't, you have to pay a penalty to the tenant. In Chicago, it's $100. In Evanston, it's $200 plus attorney fees. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, that $100, $200. But if you own several properties and you make a business out of renting these properties and you don't attach these summaries, then you can get into a lot of trouble because, again, it's ripe for a class action and those attorney fees can get very high very quickly. So if you are in one of those jurisdictions, make sure that your client, if your client's a landlord, knows to attach the latest version of the summary or the ordinance, depending on where they are. If it's in Evanston, they have to attach the actual law. If it's in Mount Prospect in Chicago, they have to attach a summary of the law that the local municipality writes for you. And that's easy to find because it's on Chicago's website or Mount Prospect's website or Urbana's website. Now, here's what you have to keep in mind. It has to be the latest version of the summary or the law, and it has to be complete. There's a case called Kopnik versus J.L. Wood that actually says that it can't be a partial summary. There is no substantial compliance. You can't just attach 2 out of 3 pages and say, well, I got close enough. You have to attach all the pages. One mistake I see a lot of people make is they have the tenant sign something that's in the lease saying, I received a copy of the ordinance or I received the summary. The problem is, unless you attach the summary itself, there is no way to know if it's the latest one, there is no way to know if it's the correct one, and there's no way to know if it's complete. So make sure that if you are a landlord, that you are attaching a summary or the ordinance as required, and make sure also that you make copies of it and you keep a copy of exactly what you gave to your tenant. And if you're a tenant, make sure that you get a copy of that, because in some jurisdictions you can actually terminate your lease if you don't. So that's a really important thing. So we'll start with that. The other thing to know, go at the very beginning of our journey through these ordinances, is that these are strict liability. There's a case called Lawrence versus Regent Realty from the Illinois Supreme Court, and it says that, and this is a direct quote, a landlord's obligations under the statute are absolute. There are no exceptions. And if that doesn't sound scary enough, the case law also says that the purpose of these ordinances is to protect tenants, so they are liberally construed and construed in favor of tenants. Often I get landlords who say, well, this isn't fair, I didn't know, a court won't hold me liable because I didn't know. So every landlord is presumed to know, and as a landlord's lawyer, it is your job to tell them what this law says, because if they don't, they can get hit with hundreds of thousands of dollars in attorney fees in a lawsuit because, yes, they really do go that high. So, let's start with what these ordinances apply to. Now, in Evanston, there's actually a series of exceptions right on the first page in section 5-3-1. So, for example, it doesn't apply to educational or religious institutions. So it doesn't apply to dorm rooms, basically. It doesn't apply to installment contracts. That's important to note because in Chicago, it arguably does apply. That ordinance does apply to installment contracts. So be careful about where your property is. The Evanston ordinance also is the way it's worded to exclude installment contracts. It says occupancy under a contract of sale of a dwelling unit if the occupant is the purchaser. So if you have an installment contract where the money that's being paid is construed as rent, then the Evanston ordinance still applies because the purchaser is technically a legal tenant. So keep that in mind also. The other thing to know is the Evanston exception that says transient occupancy in a hotel or motel has been held unconstitutional in a case called Evanston versus O'Leary. It's very common for people who run single room occupancy buildings or SROs. It's very common for landlords who run hotels to think that the ordinance doesn't apply to them if they are either accepting weekly rent or you're talking about short-term tenancies. In Evanston, that is just not true. In Evanston, it applies anyway under Evanston versus O'Leary. In Chicago, it's not clear. Courts have come down on both sides of that issue as to whether it applies, and Chicago has a similar exception. So be very careful, and if you are not sure, assume, because of the state of the case law, assume that the statute applies to you if you aren't sure. If you have a person who's renting a hotel on a daily basis, you're probably fine, so long as that person hasn't stayed for more than 30 days. Once you have anyone stay in your property for 32 days or longer, and that's the rule, if a person stays in your property for 32 days or longer in Chicago, assume that the ordinance applies and treat them accordingly. Now, one other thing to note, if you go to the definition section of the Evanston Ordinance and they talk about who is a landlord, you'll find this in the Chicago Ordinance also and in the Mount Prospect Ordinance. The landlord is both the owner and the managing agent. Why is that important? Because let's say that you are the owner of a single-family home, for example, and you were to let a managing company, a property manager, run your business for you. That property manager is liable for any violations of the ordinance, but so are you as the owner. Even if you don't know about them, even if you have handed off all responsibility to the managing agent, you're still responsible jointly and severally. And that's true under the Chicago Ordinance, and that's true under the Evanston Ordinance. Under the Uniform Act and the ordinances that are based on it, there is no five-unit limit like there is with the Security Deposit Return Act. In Chicago, there is an exception for owner-occupied properties of 6 units or less. However, there is no such exception in Evanston. And there is no such exception in Mount Prospect. So you need to assume, even if you have a small building, the ordinance does apply to you, even if the Security Deposit Return Act or Security Deposit Interest Act wouldn't. The ordinances based on the Uniform Act are significantly broader and significantly more dangerous to landlords while significantly more protective of tenants. And that is very important to note. So once you go through the Evanston Ordinance, you see Section 5-3-3-1, Terms and Conditions of the Rental Agreement. Now, what does that mean? That basically tells you what you can and can't put in a rental agreement. And to summarize this in a nutshell, essentially every one of these ordinances based on the Uniform Act prohibits you from contracting around the Uniform Act. In other words, you cannot, just like you can't disclaim the Security Deposit Return Act, you also can't disclaim the RLTO or the ERLTO or any other ordinance based on the Uniform Act. Any provision that violates the ordinance is going to be unenforceable. And not only that, if you attempt to enforce it, you have to pay a penalty, usually 1 or 2 months' rent, and again, plus attorney fees. And there's actually a second section in Evanston that makes very clear what they mean by this. The section called Prohibited Provisions in the Rental Agreement. That's section 5-3-3-3. And the language is very clear, and this is similar language to what you'll see across all four ordinances. A provision prohibited by the ordinance is included in a rental agreement is unenforceable. If a landlord deliberately uses a rental agreement containing any provision known to be prohibited, the tenant may recover actual damages and not more than 2 months' rent and reasonable attorney fees. So you have to be very careful because that's a lot of penalties that accrue very quickly if there's something in the lease that isn't actually legal. Now, also in these ordinances are restrictions on the right of access by the landlord. This is really important. In most of Illinois, these restrictions don't exist. However, in these four jurisdictions, a landlord must provide 48 hours notice before entry, no matter what the lease says. Not 24, not 36. It has to be 48 hours written notice. So that means if it's in the last 60 days of a lease and you want to show the apartment, you still have to provide two full days notice in writing before you go in. One other thing to keep in mind, if you don't, once again, there's a statutory penalty, usually a month or two worth of rent, and these things can add up. Now, there is a case called Krawczyk versus Levaditis that says that you can only get one penalty for each section of the ordinance, so you can't do claim stacking. However, some courts don't always follow that. So it's very important to keep in mind that you can't enter with less than 48 hours notice unless it's an emergency or the tenant actually asked you to fix something. If you want to go into the unit for any reason other than those two things, you have to give 48 hours notice. And you also cannot enter the unit, even with 48 hours notice, at a time that is inconvenient to the tenant for the purpose of harassing the tenant. And that's something to keep in mind as well. Finally, in terms of the right of access, the landlord can only enter at what are considered reasonable times. For our purposes, consider those to be business hours. Business hours are reasonably safe. Now, the other really important thing about these ordinances is that they take the Security Deposit Return Act and Security Deposit Interest Act, and they basically put them on steroids. So here we are with the statutes that would otherwise apply, but in these particular jurisdictions, the security deposit regulations are far stricter. So let's start at the beginning. Number one, you must keep it in a segregated bank account. You have to keep it separate from your own assets. So keep it in a separate bank account just for those purposes. Tell the tenant where that is. In Chicago, that's actually required to disclose the location of the deposit. And remember, the security deposit under these ordinances remains the property of the tenant. It is not the property of the landlord. You must also keep it in an interest-bearing bank account. You cannot commingle it with any of your assets for any period of time if you are the landlord. And you must pay interest on it timely. If you don't do any of those things, then you are liable to the tenant for an amount equal to double the security deposit plus attorney fees. Now, you also have to treat prepaid rent this way. So that means, let's say that you have a tenant who pays you first and last month's rent. That last month's rent, you have to treat like a security deposit, stick it in a segregated bank account that's interest-bearing, and pay interest on it, and don't commingle it. That's really important. Now, you cannot let that security deposit be commingled with your own assets, including in bankruptcy proceedings. There's a case called In re McGee that talks about how allowing creditors access to that money is actually a defalcation claim, that you cannot do anything that would endanger the tenant's security deposit because it doesn't belong to you. And that money is that you're basically holding in trust for the benefit of the tenant as the landlord. And that really cannot be understated because it cannot be overstated because essentially it creates a fiduciary duty as a matter of law that the landlord has in relation to the tenant, that the landlord owes to the tenant to keep that security deposit safe. That's not a fiduciary duty that arises under state law. It's a fiduciary duty that arises under the operation of the Uniform Act, and it's in all of these ordinances. So what that means is, if you were to commingle the security deposit with your assets, not only are you looking at a violation of the ordinance and the penalties that go with that, you're looking at a claim for breach of fiduciary duty and everything that goes with that. Now, when you want to return the security deposit, make sure that when you return it, you are returning it in full, or if you are going to withhold any part of it, the security deposit has to be withheld, just like we said before, only for things that are actually damaged items. Do not withhold that. A lot of common mistakes I see are these. Number one, you put in the lease that security deposit cannot be used as rent, and then apply the security deposit towards rent due at the end of the lease. You can't have it both ways. If the security deposit can't be used as rent, then it can't be applied towards rent at the end of the lease. Number two, using it towards wear items. Using the security deposit for cleaning, for light bulbs, for painting is a quick way to get sued. Don't do it. And third, not providing the deposit back and a breakdown of your deductions within 30 days. That is really important. Because if you don't, even if every deduction you make is proper, it's very likely, because if you didn't return it timely, you're going to get hit with a lawsuit anyway. If you don't have the receipts, you're going to get hit with a lawsuit anyway. And so the safest thing you can do is just return the security deposit. Now, some landlords have stopped accepting security deposits altogether and started charging what's called a move-in fee. There's been some litigation on whether or not move-in fees are actually security deposits. So far, courts have been willing to allow move-in fees that are non-refundable. However, in a case called Stennis versus Mac Properties, the appellate court basically said that what makes the move-in fee non-refundable is that it says it's non-refundable, number one, and it's not a full month of rent like a security deposit is. So, can you charge a $350 move-in fee against $1,200 in rent? Probably, so long as you say it's non-refundable. But can you charge a $1,200 move-in fee against $1,200 in rent? Probably not. That's probably a security deposit, and it's going to have to be treated as such. Now, these ordinances also require you to disclose the name of the person who's authorized to manage the building and a 24-hour way to get in touch with them. And you also have to disclose the name of the person who's authorized to receive notices and service of process for the building, and any code violations for the building for the previous 12 months. Now, for Evanston, it's longer than 12 months. You have to disclose all code violations ever. So this is important to realize, because if you don't disclose these code violations, or you don't disclose the name of the landlord, you don't disclose the name of the managing agent on the front of the lease, the tenant can terminate the lease and file suit against the landlord for damages under the ordinance. And again, it's strict liability, a statutory penalty, plus attorney fees. So make sure, as a landlord, that you are disclosing everything you're required to on the front of the lease. The next is the requirement to maintain the premises in accordance with the municipal code. In other words, the Uniform Act and the ordinances based on it make very clear that it is the landlord's responsibility to maintain the premises. The landlord can't make the tenant pay for things. The landlord can't make the tenant repair things. It's the landlord's responsibility, and you cannot rent a property as is. And we talked about this before in the context of the warranty of habitability, but this gives that teeth. Anything that goes wrong in the unit is really the landlord's responsibility to fix. It's the landlord's responsibility to maintain the premises. Now, that does not mean that the tenant can go around and trash the place. And in fact, if the tenant were to go around and trash the place, the ordinance actually allows the landlord to sue the tenant for those damages and recover the landlord's attorney fees. But what it does mean is that the responsibility for maintaining the property rests squarely with the landlord. Evanston does have an exception that says that the tenant is allowed to do specified maintenance tasks so long as it's entered into in good faith and negotiated, and it isn't intended to diminish the obligation of the landlord to other tenants. In other words, a landlord can't pass off his requirement to maintain the premises onto a tenant. The landlord can say that one tenant has to do certain things in the tenant's unit so long as the tenant had a meaningful choice in the matter and entered into it in good faith. And that's important to remember. The other thing that this provision does is it creates a cause of action called failure to maintain. And that's basically the same as a breach of the implied warranty of habitability. However, the difference here is that all of a sudden it's fee shifting. That lost value to the unit, which is what you're suing for, the difference between the rental value you're paying and what it's actually worth, all of a sudden that's a fee-shifting provision now. And so you have to be very careful when you're maintaining the premises to use licensed personnel, make sure that it is in good condition for your tenant, because if you don't, you can be hit with a lawsuit for that. Here is something else that's important to know. The Evanston Ordinance and the Chicago Ordinance both contain a provision called Waiver of Landlord's Right to Terminate. And it's basically the codification of something that already exists in Illinois law that a lot of people, including attorneys, don't know about. If you accept rent after a breach of the lease by the tenant, you waive that breach, even if it's the breach was non-payment of rent, and even if the payment is partial. And the only exception to that, basically, is if it's a five-day notice and full payment isn't made, but even then, you have to issue a new five-day notice then and start all over because rent was accepted. So, keep in mind, if you accept rent after a breach of the lease, no matter how much you accept, you've waived that breach moving forward. Now, some leases attempt...
Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master. Esquire CLE's second verification code is the word master. M-A-S-T-E-R, master.
To get around this by saying that acceptance of rent doesn't waive it. But remember, you can't waive or disclaim the ordinance by contract, which means you can't contract around this requirement. If you accept rent in one of these jurisdictions, and really in the state of Illinois generally, after a breach, you can't evict or sue your tenant over that breach. One other thing to keep in mind. The ordinances all require the landlord to deliver possession on time and make the landlord liable for not doing so. So if the landlord and tenant enter into a lease that's supposed to begin July 1st, the landlord doesn't deliver possession until July 10th. The tenant has several different options. The tenant can either terminate the lease, or the tenant can sue for damages, or the tenant can get a statutory penalty, again, plus attorney fees. The Evanston Ordinance also has something called self-help for minor defects. And tenant lawyers should be familiar with this. It basically is a repair and deduct rule. Now, you have to be very careful with this repair and deduct rule, and I usually recommend that even tenants who are living in properties that have problems pay the rent in full because it is a difficult rule to follow. And basically what it does is it allows you to deduct certain things from the rent if you repaired them after you already notified the landlord. The problem is that it's really specific about what you have to do. Typically, you have to notify the landlord in writing, not only of the problem and of your intention to repair and deduct, and you have to get a licensed person to do it, and it has to be below a certain amount. If it's a certain amount in this case is $200. If it's above $200, you can still do it, but only if it's a code violation for which the city of Evanston has cited the landlord. So really, the easier thing to do is just to file suit for failure to maintain. And so that's my response is generally the tenants who say, can I deduct rent? First of all, if you're not in a uniform act jurisdiction, it's just not a good idea because the law is pretty scattershot on that. And second, it's not a good idea because you'll be hit with an eviction suit. So it's really a much better idea to just file a separate lawsuit for failure to maintain in practice. Now, one word that gets thrown around a lot is retaliatory eviction. Actually, I guess that's two words. But retaliatory eviction is this idea that if the tenant engages in some kind of protected activity, maybe complaining about the condition in the unit or something like that, and then the landlord turns around and raises the rent or terminates the lease or gives you a 5 or 10 day notice, but that's illegal. The truth is, it's really only illegal in Uniform Act jurisdictions. However, if you are in a Uniform Act jurisdiction, retaliation carries really stiff penalties. There's two important things to know about retaliation. Number one, it applies if your tenant did things like, or join a tenant union, complain about problems, go to the media. In other words, if your tenant is being a pain in the landlord's ass, then in reality, the tenant is probably doing something protected unless they're doing something like not paying rent. But if they're doing repair and deduct, remember, that's protected. A lot of landlords say, I don't want to deal with this, and then give them a 5 or 10 day notice to get them out. But here's the problem. Under the law, those actions are presumed to be retaliatory if they took place within 1 year. So let's say your tenant complains to you about cockroaches in the unit, you go in and spray, and you decide the tenant is not worth the trouble, so you tell them you're not renewing their lease at the end of their lease. And that happened within 1 year of their complaint about the cockroaches. Well, guess what? You just did something that is presumed retaliatory under the law, and you owe them the statutory penalty, which is 2 months' rent plus attorney fees. Now, it's really important to understand that that presumption can be devastating because it changes the entire nature of the case from the tenant has to prove the tenant's case to the landlord has to prove the landlord's case. So, if you are a landlord, it is important to maintain good terms with your tenants, number one. And also, it's important not, basically, don't increase rents on tenants who are having problems. Don't issue termination notices. Don't say you're not renewing tenancies without talking to a lawyer first who has experience in this area. And sometimes it is actually safer just to renew a tenancy or to negotiate a deal where the tenant leaves rather than file an eviction or issue a 30-day notice or a 10-day notice or a 5-day notice and get hit with kind of a lawsuit. Now, the other thing that these ordinances all make illegal that you should know about is essentially you cannot lock a tenant out. And now you should know this from what used to be called the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act and what is now called the Eviction Act, that you can't exercise self-help. But landlords still do it all the time. But here is the thing, that there is in Illinois a tort claim for what's called wrongful eviction. And it can be really expensive for a landlord who exercises self-help. But in these Uniform Act jurisdictions, what you're getting instead is a fee-shifting statutory violation that carries double or triple damages, and that can be six figures or more. So never, ever, ever exercise self-help in locking out a tenant. Just don't do it because you are asking for trouble. No matter where in the state you are, it is not legal to lock out a tenant unless you've gone through the court process and you're getting a sheriff-executed eviction. It is also not legal to have the police remove a tenant from your apartment. You have to have the sheriff do it with an order of possession. So, that's the major points of the ordinances that we've gone over. There are differences between each one. For example, Mount Prospect security deposit regulations mirror the state act more closely than they mirror the Uniform Act. That's something to keep in mind. Also, for example, in Evanston, it's a little bit stricter than it is in Chicago when it comes to some things like the summary that we talked about earlier. In Evanston, it's the entire law instead. One thing to be aware of, if you are in Evanston, the ordinance says that you have to attach a copy of the entire ordinance to the lease, whether you use the Evanston model lease or not. But the Evanston model lease has language in it that says that the Evanston model lease is enough and you don't have to attach the summary. The Evanston model lease is wrong because the ordinance trumps the lease. Give the ordinance chapter anyway as required, no matter what the model lease says, because it's the ordinance that applies and the model lease doesn't have the force of law. So that's really important to note. Here's some other things to keep in mind that are useful about these laws. One thing you'll notice about the jurisdictions that have adopted the Model Act, so for example, Chicago, Evanston, Mount Prospect, Urbana, and even those jurisdictions that haven't, but where the Security Deposit Interest Act or the Security Deposit Return Act applies, it's important to note that you can use these as tools in cases, for example, in fair housing. And here's what I mean. It sounds strange to say, but generally speaking, when you have landlords who are not following the Fair Housing Act, they're not going to be going out of their way to return security deposits. They may also be violating the Fair Housing Act by doing things like not returning security deposits to their African-American tenants, or discriminating in the lease on the basis of disability and using the security deposit to pay for reasonable accommodations, things like that. So you can actually use these statutes as tools in your fair housing cases, and here's why. Remember that we're talking about strict liability statutes here, which means that unlike the Fair Housing Act, which technically is strict liability but also has a very fact-based inquiry, here you're talking about no damages, determinations because there's a statutory penalty in most instances. So it's really easy to prove, so long as if you know that the security deposit was commingled or not returned, there you are. That's the entire inquiry. Case closed. And it's fee shifting. And oftentimes, these claims can be what's called inextricably intertwined with your fair housing claims. Now, how can that be, you wonder? So let's say that you're having a case and you have two causes of action. One is under the Fair Housing Act, and one is for security deposit violations. And you're saying, well, how can those two things possibly be connected? Well, if you want to know whether or not a landlord returns security deposits, you're going to need to look at the tenant files and the tenant records. If you want to know whether or not the landlord was accepting security deposits the same way from everybody, you're going to need to look at exactly those same documents. A lot of the briefing is going to be the same. A lot of the discovery is going to be the same. And what that basically means is, because under Illinois law, you are allowed to recover attorney fees for all claims that are inextricably intertwined with each other, whether you win them or lose them. You have claims here under the Uniform Act that can be slam dunk winners even if your fair housing claim is not quite as strong. And what it does is it gives the landlord a powerful incentive to settle, because they know and you know that you have a security deposit claim that they are dead to rights on. What it does is it allows you to say to them, you can run up the attorney fees, or we can settle this now. And you can craft the settlement in such a way as to cure the fair housing violation while using the security deposit as a tool to get that settlement that you wouldn't have had otherwise. Because the security deposit litigation guarantees that there's going to be some kind of attorney fee payout at the end, and that can get really expensive. It can also get really expensive if we're talking about large landlords. 100, 200 units in a building, $1,000 per unit as a security deposit, and all of a sudden, that's a lot of money you're talking about in statutory penalties if there was some kind of policy related to, for example, not paying security deposit interest on time. So if you know that this building, for example, this particular landlord is discriminating against certain tenants and how they maintain the property, for example, then what you can do is you can attach a failure to maintain claim, you can attach a security deposit claim onto your fair housing claim, assuming the facts are there, and what you've done is you've strengthened your fair housing claim by adding claims that are easier to prove because they're strict liability and that allow you access into discovery that otherwise you might not be able to get to. A couple of final points. Whereas the Model Act may not apply to every lease in Illinois, it is possible to include it by statute, or if you, for example, were to attach the summary to a lease that doesn't need it. So let's say that you have a lease that is in Skokie and you attach a copy of the Evanston Ordinance. There have been some courts that have held, well, now you're bound by the Evanston Ordinance. So you need to be careful with how you do that. Second, if you see a lease floating around that says don't use in the city of Chicago, it's probably a good idea not to use that in Evanston or Urbana or Mount Prospect either, because whereas they're all slightly different, if it violates the law in one, it probably violates the law in all three, and you're still going to end up getting sued in those other jurisdictions. Don't assume Chicago is the only jurisdiction that has the landlord-tenant ordinance. Another thing, if you are on the defense side and you have a tenant who's saying, I want my security deposit back, even if you think you're in the right, as a point of practice, it's usually a better idea to just return the security deposit. And I say this not as somebody who deals mostly with tenants' rights, but somebody who, from a practical perspective, knows how expensive these cases can get. Even if you end up winning, remember that these are fee shifting cases for the prevailing plaintiff, not just the prevailing party. So if you win, you get your pride, but you don't get your attorney fees back, and your client can be out a lot of money. These can be expensive cases to litigate, and it's usually not worth $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 to prove that you correctly, that you were right when you withheld $1,000. Just give them the $1,000 back and be done. One other thing. The One of the things that you cannot do, according to the ordinance, is put a fee-shifting provision the other way in the lease. I see a lot of landlords try and do this. They try to even the playing field, or so they think, by putting in the lease that the tenant has to pay the landlord's attorney fees if the landlord's the prevailing party. Well, the first problem is you can't do that under the ordinances, especially in eviction cases. And all you'll do by filing that kind of lawsuit is get yourself hit with a lawsuit. And second, that can end up being turned very quickly into a malpractice claim because it so clearly says you can't do that. So that's something that you need to keep in mind. If you have any questions about any of this, and I know this was a relatively brief overview, and there is a lot more that you can find, the resources that I would recommend, number one, the Evanston Residential Landlord Tenant Ordinance is available on the City of Evanston website. And that is Chapter 5 of the Evanston Municipal Code. That's Section 5-3-1 through Section 5-3-12-5. If you want to see the Chicago Ordinance, it's at Chapter 5 of the Chicago Municipal Code, so that's Chapter 5-12-010, and it goes through it goes through 5-12-180. In Mount Prospect, the ordinance is Section 23.1801, and it goes through Section 23.1821. And I highly recommend that you read those, especially if you're doing any kind of work that involves the Uniform Act. I also am here to answer questions that you may have. Like I said, I am the Director of Fair Housing at Open Communities, a not-for-profit in Evanston, and you can either email me. My email is Cheryl, S-H-E-R-Y-L, at open-communities.org, or you can give me a call. The number here is 847-501-5760. I'm extension 107, and I am happy to answer any questions that you might have just to make sure that you stay on the straight and narrow in this area, because there can be a lot of landmines if you aren't careful. And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for listening. I hope this has been informative, and have a wonderful day.